Well, good morning, everyone. I'm not attaching this yet because I'm going to put it down here by a speaker. But am I coming across loud enough? You can hear me in the back? A little louder? Okay. My topic is the conclusion of the whole matter. I'm hearing some feedback here. Can you hear it? No? Okay. And I want to begin this morning with a 8 to 9 minute video presentation that I believe is important to help establish the mood for this subject within Ecclesiastes. And brothers and sisters, I ask your forbearance regarding this video because it is admittedly uncharacteristic and perhaps unprecedented within a Christadelphian presentation. But I trust your reactions and your emotions that you feel as it begins will dramatically change as it proceeds, with the reason for its selection and use here becoming apparent very quickly as we get into this morning's subject. I don't know that the sound is going to come through real good, and there's not an awful lot of conversation, and frankly, the conversation is not really important. The visual will tell the story. Okay, that was the story of Carl and Ellie. And this video was selected as it has appeal to all ages. It's a universal message. And I'm assuming that the emotions of viewers of all ages went from wonder and delight, as well as why on earth are we seeing this here, to sadness at the progression of the life cycle portrayed in this presentation. And although this may apply most particularly to us in or approaching advanced years, you know, does it not bring a tear to the eye? Does it not cause you to consider your loved ones and the relative briefness of mortal life and happiness? Because in this presentation, we cannot help but apply this eventuality to our own lives. You know, husbands, can you look at the character Ellie, at the mutual love and togetherness depicted between this couple, and not consider that you or your wife will be in Carl's place at some future date, should time go on? Young people, do you not see your own hopes, your dreams, and your joys in these animated characters? In fact, do we not all begin with imagination and wonder and excitement at our prospects for life and adventure? And are you not bummed out by the eventuality of it all ending? And for the most part, without having accomplished much of what we imagine as young children, after what most grandparents will assure you is a very short lifetime that very quickly passes by. Now, of course, many of the dreams and aspirations that we have in our youth are overly ambitious. Very few young girls actually turn out to be princesses, and not many young baseball players make it to the big leagues. But consider, this depiction was of a very good life in terms of life's joys and marital happiness. And would we not guess that most people on this earth do not experience such a blessed life as portrayed in that short video? And yet, blessed lives also end, often suddenly, causing the thoughtful person to ask, what is the purpose of all this? What is the purpose of life? What has all this time and effort amounted to? Would you turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 7, please? And you might want to keep your finger in the book of Ecclesiastes, because we'll be going there frequently. Am I coming through loud enough? A little? Okay. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 2. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. That is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. And laying this to our hearts, my dear brethren and friends, was the intended purpose of this rather unorthodox introduction, as well as the goal of this morning's presentation. Indeed, it is a depressing and yet a motivating realization for mankind to realize that how fleeting this life is, and that all we are and that all we might become will end, and that the majority of those living will become, as Obadiah says, as though they had not been. This is a frightening thing for mortal man to consider. For the most part, mankind has denied this realization through various speculations and various beliefs involving life after death and some type of a spirit existence, a happy hunting ground, a reincarnation, heaven, all in an attempt to confirm the serpent's lie, "Ye shall not surely die." And even when these inventions are not really even believed, it serves to comfort and to take their minds off of the matter, but at the same time interfering and obstructing any real desire or attempt to understand and search out the purpose of life. Go to any funeral. It seems to be taboo to acknowledge that the deceased person is not really somewhere conscious, aware and existing in a spirit form somewhere, usually a happy place, looking down on family and friends. And I have a little piece from a funeral card from a neighbor of ours that I wanted to share with you here. And on the funeral card it said, you know, with his name and all, "Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am 1,000 winds that blow. I am the diamond glints on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn's rain. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die." I have no idea what this means, and I doubt that anyone else does either, other than to direct one's thoughts away from death and sorrow, get back to life, get on with it. Don't think about this. And it sounds so pleasant, and it's so alluring, because to think about it is a pretty harsh reality. But I am sure it helps those relatives and friends to move on with their lives without giving any serious consideration to their own impending death or the death of their other loved ones. It is surely comforting to the natural man to be told that one doesn't die, but rather they have moved on to a better place. The truth, of course, does not allow for such distractions. The truth is honest. Truth is forthright. Dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return. Look at Ecclesiastes 3, chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. "For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they all have one breath. So that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. All go into one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again." And once this is comprehended, once this is acknowledged, the immediate reaction is, uh-oh, there's got to be something else. There's got to be a way of escaping this. and thus follows the search for the truth of man's existence and the purpose of our existence. And there is indeed a way out for those who search and find it, and that way out has been made known from the fall of mankind in the garden, that God had a purpose in His creation. What is that purpose? What is the purpose of man upon this earth? Well, in Revelation 4:11, if you'll turn to that, we read of John's vision of the glorified bride of Christ gathered around Christ. He's sitting upon the heavenly throne representing the Spirit of God, and the Spirit's declaration of the purpose of God in creating man. And Revelation 4, verse 11 says, "Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for Thou hast created all things, and for Thy pleasure they are and were created." And we find further that the earth itself was created with mankind in mind, from Isaiah 45:18. "For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God Himself that formed the earth and made it, He hath established it, He created it not in vain, He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else." So, what we find here is that God had a purpose. He created for His pleasure, thus forming the earth to be inhabited as a suitable place for His creatures and for mankind. And this, of course, is contrary to the wild imagination and theories of evolutionists. Yet credible scientific evidence demonstrates that our earth is unique, and the so-called existence of other habitable planets is in all reality just a pipe dream, no matter what all the Star Wars shows and all show. The earth is unique, created by God to be inhabited. So God created for His pleasure, and is not the concept of God finding pleasure in His creation something that we as mortals can readily understand? Do not we identify with that? We are, after all, created in His image. We know that mankind glories in His accomplishments, of course, usually neglecting consideration of his own dependence upon his Creator and accomplishment through God's blessings. But the pleasure that God is talking about here is not just a fleeting thing. Recall that Christ tells us, "It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." It's His good pleasure to give His servants the kingdom. Why? In Psalms 147, "The Lord taketh pleasure in them that fear Him, in those that hope in His mercy," as we have been hearing this morning. And in Psalms 149:32, "The Lord taketh pleasure in His people. He will beautify the meek with salvation." This is something our God desires to do. And brethren, our comprehension of the mercy and the goodness of God in His expressed intent regarding us and this earth constitutes our hope. It represents His loving kindness toward them that fear Him, those described as broken and contrite in heart, trembling at His word. And it is those that He takes pleasure in, and it is those that He desires to honor as children in His kingdom. Now this brings us back to the title of the presentation, the conclusion of the whole matter. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. "Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." Ecclesiastes 12:13. Brethren, young people, and friends, this verse, these few words, are truly the answer to a number of things. the concern and the despondency resulting from the recognition that life is a temporary thing. It's an answer to the question of success and happiness in life. And it's an answer to the ultimate question, what is the meaning and purpose of life? Why are we here? But we might ask, how can these few words, these simply stated admonitions, really address such huge life issues? Isn't there a natural tendency to interpret Ecclesiastes 12:13 as something of a more general nature? Love God, do the right thing, be good. You know, which most people think they do anyway. In fact, what does to fear God even mean? You'll find a wide range of responses on that. Many present-day Christians reject the very idea of fear as inconsistent with the worship of a loving God. Some even advising their adherents to substitute the word love wherever they come across the word fear in relation to God in the Scripture. And we'll come back to that on another day. And also, what was Solomon attempting to say when he concluded and in effect condensed the whole of his teaching in the book of Ecclesiastes and into these three short imperatives: fear God, keep His commandments, and the duty of man? How did Solomon condense all of that book into those three imperatives? Furthermore, considering that this conclusion comes from the book of Ecclesiastes, are we not aware that we, and do we not need to address the fact that Ecclesiastes is generally regarded by the Christian community as reflecting such a pessimistic viewpoint that they believe it's inconsistent with the gospel message? Some say the whole book is summed up by the words that do in fact appear throughout the book: vanity of vanities, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Any Bible dictionary will tell us that the book of Ecclesiastes is at best perplexing, considered by some as unworthy of a place in the Bible due to its perceived skepticism and pessimism. Critics and so-styled scholars have long assailed and questioned the authenticity of the book, claiming its style is of a later period than Solomon. They usually say, that book was written either during or after the Persian period. So what they're doing is just questioning the authenticity of their book. They're questioning Solomon's authorship. But this verse, Ecclesiastes 12:13, is so important and so integral to our life and purpose that we want to spend some time today and tomorrow examining its authenticity and attempting to understand what it really represents. For the wisdom of Solomon here tells us that this is the conclusion of the whole matter, the sum total. Why is Ecclesiastes so pessimistic? Does it merely reflect frustration and the futility of life? Solomon's sudden realization of the inevitability of death and the ultimate futileness of human endeavors and achievements? Well, let us first establish that the author of Ecclesiastes is indeed Solomon. No other individual fits the descriptions given in the book itself. Look at chapter 1:1 of Ecclesiastes. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And now go down to verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Well, think about that. First of all, he calls himself son of David, king. And in verse 12, he says, king over Israel in Jerusalem. Now, think about that designation, king over Israel. No, I'm sorry, king over Israel in Jerusalem. No king after Solomon could or would have claimed to be king over Israel in Jerusalem. With the division of the kingdom into Israel in the north and Judah in the south, following Solomon's death and Rehoboam's ascension to the throne. Kings reigning in Jerusalem after that point would have been called King of Judah in Jerusalem. And of course, after Zedekiah, there were no Jewish kings in Jerusalem at all, as God had decreed. So if we take this as written by the author, they say they were king over Israel in Jerusalem. Now Solomon was also given the gift of divine wisdom, determining him the wisest man ever to live. Turn to chapter 3 of 1 Kings. First Kings 3, verses 11 and 12. And God said unto him, because thou hast asked this thing, and hast not asked for thyself long life, neither hast asked riches for thyself, nor hast asked the life of thine enemies, but hast asked for thyself understanding to discern judgment. Behold, I have done according to thy words. Lo, I have given thee a wise and an understanding heart, so that there was none like thee before thee, neither after thee shall any arise like unto thee. Boy, think about that. None before, none after. This is important. The book of Ecclesiastes is one of the products of this divinely given wisdom, recorded and preserved for our learning. What was the purpose of the book? All men in all ages have sought to understand the purpose and the meaning of life. The problem of human happiness and fulfillment. What is it? Is it wealth? Is it knowledge? Is it pleasure seeking? Those are the typical ways men seek fulfillment. Solomon in this book addresses that very question. The book of Ecclesiastes is his record of experiment and lessons learned. What is the meaning of life? And think about it. Who would be better qualified to present such an important treatise to mankind? Consider Solomon's qualification to address this subject. Unlimited resources. All possible avenues to happiness and fulfillment were open to him to be explored. Unlimited wealth. We're told in 1 Kings 10:23, Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches. Unlimited freedom to pursue any avenue he pleased without any restriction. There were no restraints. No one told Solomon, you can't do that. And most importantly, the gift of divine wisdom with which to guide and interpret his search. Now consider, by today's materialistic standard, Solomon must have been the happiest person ever to live on this earth. Think about it. That had to be the happiest person ever to live. That's our fleshy thinking. He was rich, he was wise, he was free from restraint. He could do exactly what he wanted and do exactly what he wished. And indeed, Solomon records his schemes for securing happiness through great works. His buildings, his gardens, his parks, his choirs, his orchestras. Look at chapter 2, verse 10. He says, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor. And then reflecting on this, he continues in verses 11 and 12. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man that cometh after the king, even that, what, I'm sorry, can the man do that cometh after the king, even that which hath been already done. In his opinion, he had done everything. There was nothing else to explore, to enjoy. He had done it all. Yet, the fulfillment Solomon sought was not found in all of these achievements. In addition to his best laid plans and the normal frustrations of life, as he grew older, he came face to face with the fact that time and death were the grand controlling factors of men. Look at verses 15 and 16 of chapter 2. Then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, and this also is vanity. For there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever, seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? As the fool. Only so much time. Death and the leaving of one's possessions and accomplishments behind is inevitable. With Solomon's understanding, and this is the difference, with his understanding of the role of God in men's lives and the reality of judgment, it was no longer possible for him to view man's happiness and fulfillment as consistent with a perishing world and a perishing body. So he started looking at all these great accomplishments through different eyes. Look at 2, again, chapter 2, we'll go on 17 through 19. He says, therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that should be after me. And who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. This is the expected end for all who experience life's pursuits and joys. At some point in life, time and death become the overwhelming reality. And did we not observe this in the video when the aged Carl despondently walks into his home alone after Ellie's funeral? Are we not familiar with the loneliness and depression experienced by the elderly who outlive their partners and their families and their friends? And is this not the time when mankind, perhaps for the first time seriously, truly questions the purpose and the value of life, and maybe is willing to ask that question, well, what do you believe? Or what do you think about this? Be aware, in determining whether or not to accept Solomon's conclusion as the primary principle in our lives, throughout all his vast experiment, accomplishment, and reflection, Solomon declares that his wisdom remained with him, even when he was deliberately pursuing vain pleasures for the purpose of determining their values. Chapter 2, look at verse 3. He said, I sought in mine heart to give myself into wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. I want to read that verse out of the Amplified Bible. He says, I searched in my mind how to cheer my body with wine, yet at the same time having my mind hold its course and guide me with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. He is searching this out. So let's go back, and I want to read his discourse here, verses 3 through 9. I sought in my heart to give myself into wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water, to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle, above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold, and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. I get me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men, as musical instruments, and that of all sorts. So I was great, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. The stages of Solomon's inquiry are really recorded here for us. And what was it that he found? What he finds is that much of what is presumed to be valued and desirable for happiness and fulfillment is not. While the things that are consistently overlooked and undervalued constitute the essential. And it is in Solomon's final counsel to his youth in the last two chapters of Ecclesiastes that the true nature and purpose of this book becomes clear. It is not a mere introspective review of his life and of his wisdom produced for his own satisfaction, reflecting his own self-importance. No. He is certainly not in any manner attempting to undermine faith in the divine order of things, as some critics have implied. Solomon tells a story of his own exploration of life, leading to the conclusion that men cannot live their lives apart from God, for no matter how bright life appears to them in their youth, it is a perishing thing, and without God, that brightness not only fades, it disappears. The theme of Ecclesiastes is the vanity of all human activities apart from the fear and service of God. What he tells youth is that the reality of life is not found only in the natural realm. With the right attitude, even growing old is not a problem. Remember, he says, the hoary hair is a crown of glory. The hoary head would be the white or the gray-haired person. If it be found in the way of righteousness. In other words, what he's saying is man's chief good and interest must be God, the supreme reality in man's existence is God. And man either ignores God and lives a vain existence, or he fears God, and in so doing he gains what he would call the chief good, not only in this life, but as is implied in the outcome of a divine judgment whose consequences extend beyond this life. Above all, in Ecclesiastes, the uncertainty of life and the certainty of death are proclaimed, and the necessity of seizing that fleeting opportunity to overcome the hold of death is stressed. Solomon tells youth, he says, rejoice. Rejoice in your vigor. Face the world with challenge and joy. Enjoy it. But then he also tells them that they must remember. Look at chapter 11, verse 19. Ecclesiastes 11, 19. I'm sorry, 11:9. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thy heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. And therefore, in chapter 12, verse 1, he says, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. And then down to verse 13 and 14. Therefore, hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And how do we remember our Creator? We accomplish that by following Solomon's advice to consider our end and to lay that to our heart. In our next class, we will consider what is implied by his imperatives to fear God to keep his commandments and the whole duty of man. Thank you.